timeless information for your self-care and health. HRNradio.com.
Hi, this is Russell Friedman, Moving Beyond Loss on HealthyLife.net Radio. Very excited to be with you once again. And today, our topic, our subject is a little different. Might even surprise some of you. The title for today is Living with Losses That Never End. And that may be a surprising title at some level. It may open up a debate or a discussion in some of your minds about whether any losses ever end as such. But I want to kind of give you an idea of what I'm talking about. When someone meaningful to us dies, there is an actual physical ending of their life. Our relationship with them doesn't end, other than the physical part. We can't touch them or talk to them directly in the same way. But we have an ongoing emotional or spiritual relationship with them that may be good, bad, mixed, ugly. It could be any combination of things. Divorce, generally speaking, means the physical relationship you had with your spouse ends. You don't usually live together, sleep together, all those other things. The intimacy things disappear also. But again, at some level, there is an emotional and spiritual relationship with that person, whether you like them or not, love them, hate them, whether you're happy or sad about the divorce. The event of marriage ends, and we adapt to that new reality, and the grief of that can dissipate somewhat by nature and can be helped to feel completed by doing the actions of grief recovery. But there again can be a formal ending, different than when someone dies, but still realistic. And before we go to our topic area, let's also add that in a divorce, the ending part isn't always as complete and final as it might be. Many of you listening have been through a divorce and been through a divorce where you have children. And, of course, the younger the children, the more contact you will need to sustain with your ex. Whether you like it or not, whether he or she likes it or not, you are obliged in the care of your children to communicate, sometimes to share, different weekends and different times, however you divide up the custody. There will be money issues in the care and feeding of the children and housing of them. All of that acts as a stimulus to keep reminding you of what was unfinished or incomplete. The reason you as a couple could not make it to that happy sunset a million years from now and go gently into that night even together is the fact that you weren't somehow cut out or able to be together. So in this need to be in contact verbally, on the phone, email, and so on, and often physically in the handing off the kids or bringing them back, there is a massive stimulus about what is unfinished. Now, other people who get a divorce who don't have children can have more of a final separation, a cut, if you will. You can live in a different community than your ex-spouse. For example, my ex-wife and I both live in greater Los Angeles, but she lives over in Santa Monica near the ocean. I live in the San Fernando Valley in Studio City. And while it's, a half-hour, 40-minute drive without traffic from one to the other, our lives don't intersect. We're not in the same social circle or in the same business world. We don't do the same things. We don't interact with the same groups of friends. We have a few in common left over, but we rarely ever in the same place together, which makes, regardless of grief recovery or not, getting emotionally complete, it makes a physical separation, which at one level certainly makes it easier to learn to move forward in life without that person in your life. Again, whether you liked him or not or didn't like him, it isn't even the issue. The issue is a physiological separation that so that you're not constantly stimulated or reminded about them. And with that, the dredging up of old, unfinished, sometimes painful things. But again, as I was saying, there are people for whom an ongoing loss is this need to stay in touch with their former spouse because of the connection to the children. And sometimes on a daily or weekly basis, needing to communicate with someone that you may not want to communicate with, but you don't have a vote. You have to do it in the interest of your children. So that becomes, along with the topic today, a loss that never ends. You know, if people come and do grief recovery method and learn how to take actions to feel more complete with their spouse, they can certainly be more practical and emotionally effective in having to deal with that spouse on a regular basis. But boy, it is, I have had to help an awful lot of people who weren't necessarily looking for this kind of help, who were trying to make it work better, the aftermath of a divorce, when they hadn't done any emotional work. You can't just apply practical solutions to an emotional problem, because practical is intellectual, it's academic. Emotional is emotional. It doesn't come under that heading. And so you can't, sometimes it's like shopping for milk in a hardware store. You can't use the tools on one thing to work on another. But I just wanted to make sure, as we kind of barge into the topic of living with losses that never end, that we don't exclude the divorcees of both genders who have to interact with their spouses and find that very difficult. I can tell you I get an awful lot of calls from divorcees, male and female, just struggling with the constant reminder built into the, I mean, if you hear the voice of your ex-spouse, the voice itself is a stimulus, a reminder. You know, and often a painful one when there's been a divorce. You know, rarely is that reminder a sweet, positive, loving one when what you're left with is the ravages of divorce. So, moving into the main thrust of our topic today, living with losses that never end, and why I chose to do it today. Why is it today's topic? Last month, I made a trip to North Carolina. Beautiful place. I did some driving there from the airports to the places I was going to be. I even played some golf there before my speech. And I made a speech to a group of parents of children with hemophilia. And many of you probably know what hemophilia is at a general level. There's something very specific within the tragedy of the condition or disease of hemophilia that you may not have heard of. And it's called the inhibitors, or the inhibitor group. And these are children who are hemophiliacs who have a compounding, life-threatening degree of difficulty because their body and misguided, although maybe it's a guided attempt to help them, will reject the very medications they need to help them. And so while the medication goes in, their body develops antibodies to fight off this helper, thinking it's an invader. And obviously you can't have a rational discussion with your internal chemistry. So all kinds of things have had to be done, which I'm, you know, not technically knowledgeable enough to explain to you, of how this group of children and their parents and the medical community around them, what they have to do to help these children and the kind of alert that they have to be on 24/7. While hemophiliacs have a life-threatening issue that they have to deal with, it's manageable to a maximal degree. The inhibitor group, it's not so easily manageable. In a manner of speaking, a little bit overly dramatic perhaps, but it's like living with a guillotine poised over your head 24/7, and you never know if that will slip and fall. Obviously, the children are affected to the degree they understand at their various ages and maturity to understand the threat. But the parents obviously understand it in a terrifying way. And so living with fear and terror of what would happen to your offspring who you love is a huge emotional burden. In addressing, this is the second time I've addressed a group. I did one here in California last year, and I'll be doing another one in New York, next year. I found that the best way to help these parents was to help them listen and talk to each other better. And here's the basic idea, and I think everyone listening will relate to this, and you don't have to have a child in that situation or a spouse with a illness to understand what I'm about to say. in a kind of traditional sense, and please excuse the stereotype of this, in that family with an inhibitor child with hemophilia, it's a high possibility that the mother will be the stay-at-home custodial parent and the dad will go off to work. Again, not to make a stereotype of that. It can be reversed. It can be shared. It can be any combination of things. But just take that one idea. So the woman, the mother, is with the child all day long, whether it goes to school or not. The mother is the go-to person for making sure the medical things that happen do, and there are many of them that have to happen on a regular basis, that the avoidance of dangerous situations and problems is being alerted to, and that when anything does happen, if the child falls, an internal bruise can get filled with blood. I mean, things, excuse my graphicness here today, but there are things that you and I don't think about or worry about because they are not in the main concerns for us. They are in the main for them. And so just imagine what it might be like to be the custodial parent, just say the mom, and every moment that you're awake and probably some that you're asleep is devoted to preoccupation, to concern, to worry, to fear about what might happen, what could happen, what may happen indeed, and what you would need to do in an emergency to deal with it. Imagine the toll that takes on you. Now, let's go to another imagination. When I talk to these parents, I often have them kind of close their eyes, the moms and the dads, whatever they are in their family sequence, and ask them if they can remember the moment, the day that they knew, if it's the mom when she knew she was pregnant, and the moment the dad became aware. Often for the dad is when he feels the kicking of the baby in the mommy's tummy, when he feels it through her belly. But each of them will have their own moment of the power of that awareness with the pregnancy. And when that happens, we automatically begin to do something. We may not even be consciously aware we're doing it, but we start internally developing hopes, dreams, and expectations about what our child will be and what his or her life will be and what kind of a parent we'll be. And all of us will swear that we're going to be better parents than our parents were to us. Even if our parents were good for us, we're going to be better. We're going to improve it. If we had a difficult time with awkward parents with problems, we're going to be better. We're not going to make the same mistakes. And we all make that vow. Of course, it's an impossible thing to accomplish, but to try to do it is a good thing. Anyhow, so I have the parents kind of close their eyes and imagine how they felt when they first learned they had a baby coming, and all of those hopes, dreams, and expectations. And even as I stand in the front of the room addressing this group of people, and they have their eyes closed, I can see the smiles. I can see the feelings they're having, remembering something from 5, 10, 15, or 20 years ago. And then I have to shift them and ask them to think about when they first became aware, when their child was diagnosed with this condition. And then secondarily, when it maybe shifted from just plain hemophilia to inhibitor to the more difficult degree of survival, what that did to them. And the degree to which the awareness of the condition and then the severity of the complication affected their hopes, dreams, and expectations about the future. All the things you hope for. Now, generally speaking, the active carriers of this condition are boys. Girls may have the condition, but it may not activate. Occasionally it does. So generally you have a little boy, and now let's just go, you know, a little bit stereotype or cliche here. Boys run and play and want to, you know, jump off of buildings and do all kinds of physical things when they're young. And now they're inhibited from much of that. Now all of your hopes and dreams as the mom or dad of that child are affected, modified by the caution, care, and concern that have to be taken on a regular basis. So now we have a group of people who had all these incredible natural hopes and dreams and a condition to come that affects that dramatically. Now, let's go back to our setup where you have the mom as stay-at-home, taking care of this child. And remember what I said earlier with the divorce setup, where when you see your spouse or hear their voice, it's a stimulus to remind you that the hopes, dreams, and expectations you had for the marriage didn't come true. If you're with your child all day long who has this limiting condition, okay, it's a constant reminder of the things that can't happen, that mustn't happen, or it'll be fatal, of the alert, of the fear. So you are living on a razor's edge yourself as the custodial parent of a child that you have to watch like a hawk. Many of your freedoms are taken away, so there's another loss in that, okay? And this is not a repairable condition. It's one that the child and then the parents have to live with. They can't just, it doesn't get better, which is really part of our title today, Living with Losses That Never End. So imagine again, you're the mom, you're the custodial parent, all day living with that kind of tension in your body, the fear, never really being able to close your eyes, having kind of one eye open, listening for sounds and ideas to just make sure. Pretty awkward to live that way. The tension in your body, the fear, you know, and no matter, people can tell you to do meditation and relax and all like that, and you almost want to laugh at them and say, you try it. Try living where you have to be on high alert in like a radar surveillance cone at everything. In the meantime, the husband, father, again, using our cliche, has gone off to work, and he works hard. Because a family like that, although it may get some support from government agencies and some funding, it's very expensive to have a child with a unique medical problem. It is not cheap. It ain't free. And the dad works hard. And when he comes home, he is preoccupied with the things that have happened. It's his job. Because let's face it, male or female here, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that making a living in this dog-eat-dog world, in this political world where even politics of a corporation or a company, the up and down of the financial world, no matter what area you're in, you can lose your job or get a demotion or a pay cut or a sideways move that isn't valuable. It can happen all the time. So when you come home from your job, you are preoccupied with those things. Come home to your wife, again, using this traditional family, who is preoccupied with her feelings about not being able to relax. And while we live in a culture, in a society with a 50% divorce rate, it is my personal belief, although there are no real hard statistics to gather on this, that the divorce rate in families that have a unique medical situation like this one and others, where the loss never ends, it never changes, it never gets better, that the divorce rate is substantially higher. And I'm going to just throw that out there. You know, if someone wanted to debate that, fine. And I have met people who will argue that and say that the condition sometimes brings them closer together. And I would agree with that. But I would also agree with the word sometimes. It doesn't happen for all or even most of the families. It tends to divide them, in part because we are all different and unique, in part because we all have a limited relationship to understanding the feelings we have when we have a condition that's outside the norm. In a perfect world, our children don't have that kind of condition, and we're not forced to live with that kind of fear. So the question becomes now, how do the parents, the guardians, interact with each other at the end of a day when they do get back together? And again, if we take this whole story and just reverse the gender, it doesn't change the story. The dad is the stay-at-home, kind of Mr. Mom, if you'll allow that, doing all that and having the same fears and feelings that he would, you know, that a woman would. And the woman goes off to the marketplace and works and does, she's a stockbroker, doctor, lawyer, whatever. And it has different preoccupations, because what she's doing all day while preoccupying her, it does not at the same time affect all her hopes, dreams, and expectations about her child, because she's focused on something else. She may be focused on making a living, and indirectly that connects back to husband and child, but the stay-at-home parent is in the situation where anything that happens any minute could be fatal. And so, and I don't mean to be heavy-handed here, but I want to set up the idea of what it feels like to try to talk to someone when you're the one who has all these fears, and the someone you're talking to, your spouse, your life mate doesn't hear you, doesn't listen well, dismisses you. And so we'll leave that as a tease for the next section. Let's go away. This is Russell Friedman, Moving Beyond Loss, HealthyLife.net Radio. Don't go far away.
You're listening to CHSR Real Radio on the web.
Hi, this is Russell Friedman back on Moving Beyond Loss on HealthyLife.net Radio, the great, great, great radio network that we are so proud to be associated with. I was talking just before the break about what it might be like to spend all day long with your child who has an illness condition that puts their life at risk any given moment. Anything, something could happen to put them in really in serious harm's way. And at the other side, talking about going off to work, which has its own degree of difficulty, coping in a world where everyone's climbing the corporate ladder or whatever the business is, the variations in the money availability. I mean, we all lived through in 2007, 2008, 2009, the whole kind of downgrading of our financial worth with the 401ks and everything. And that's just a reality out there. Survival is tough. It's, you know, dog eat dog is not what we mean here, but making a living, bringing home the bacon and so on has its own degree of difficulty. But as I was saying, in doing that, it doesn't necessarily provoke us to a, as a stimulus about the unrealized hopes, dreams, and expectations we would have about our child. It may take us to other fears, but not that one. So now at the end of the day, we have the custodial parent, and now the out in the workplace parent comes home, and now they got to communicate with each other. Now, it probably shouldn't be difficult for anybody listening to understand that the custodial parent has his or her heart full, mind full, soul full of a degree of anguish and fear and exhaustion because it's a 24/7. Even when the kid is off at school, and perhaps there are teachers and nurses and administrators there who can be helpful, we still have a situation where your phone could ring. And I imagine these moms or dads at home, when their cell phone rings in the middle of the day and their kid's at school, their first kind of thought fear has to be terror. Uh-oh. And then hoping against hope it's not a call. Get over here right away. We're putting your kid in the emergency room, you know. And so it should be fairly obvious that that spouse, that parent, co-parent, would have a rather large need to debrief the emotions of their day. In order to do that, they have to have a safe co-parent who knows how to listen in an appropriate and effective way, okay, who doesn't at the same time endorse pain but can hear it and not necessarily take it in. And at the same time, while that co-parent, who stay-at-home co-parent, has to debrief, guess what? The one out in the workforce needs to debrief. It's a different set of thoughts and feelings, but essentially it's two human beings who are life partners needing to be helpmates to each other, to be heard. Listening is one thing, hearing is another. So when I address these groups of parents who have this particular situation or other parallel things with ongoing losses, it's about how to listen and talk to each other. There's also a skill to debriefing and telling about your day without using it as a overwhelming litany of pain that can get munged on your partner. There's a way to talk about what's going on without it turning it into something that's just a disgorging over and over of how badly you feel. Because that actually makes you good at feeling bad. On this program from time to time, you've heard me say something that sounds a bit like a riddle. I will ask a large group of people, what is the best thing to do when you feel grief? And they'll say, talk about your grief. And I'll say, talking about grief makes you good at talking about grief. What's missing is recovery. What's missing is what do I do about it? In the parallel, I'll often say it's imagine a drunk sitting at a bar, talking, so to speak, with the bartender and saying to the bartender, well, I really have a problem with this alcohol. I really have a problem with drinking, but then never going to get sober, never do anything about it. Talking about pain makes an identity with your pain. So little skills I have to teach people, and I don't mean to minimize them by calling them little, but they are really smallish things that if you don't do them right, become big and dangerous things. They are the kinds of things that split couples up. Couples who might not really should be split up. Couples who are really good mates, but if you don't know how to talk and if you don't know how to listen, it's a recipe for disaster. It's a recipe for disaster in all marriages, but if you add this compounding component of a child with a life-threatening illness, now the stakes change, and the degree to which it becomes essential to learn how to listen better and talk better go up exponentially. So in doing this, part of what I teach the families is the same six myths that you have, those of you who have listened to the show on a regular basis, you probably can recite them as well as I can, because almost every month on the show I talk about them. So let's give them a name and a face, because we'll see how important they become in this context. In the order that we tend to say them and write them on our books, the first myth is the myth, don't feel bad, which is said to people who do feel bad, which makes no sense at all. So if you tell me you feel bad and I say don't feel bad, you're going to go, uh-oh, someone's not listening. I'm trying to say the truth and they're telling me not to feel that way, which implies there's something wrong with feeling that way. And we tend to have learned that in childhood when a little 3 or 4-year-old tells you they've had a hard time at preschool and they've got tears in their eyes and you say, don't feel bad, here, have a cookie, you'll feel better. And the cookie doesn't make them feel better, it just makes them feel different. But it sets up an idea that feeling bad is bad. So this is a foundation issue. Now, let's put it in context, and then we'll come back to the myths. So I'm the husband. I come home. My wife has been with our child who has a condition all day long. And I say, how you doing? She says, I've had a really hard day with Butch, our kid. And the husband makes a horrible mistake and says, don't feel bad, honey. You did the best you could. But she does feel bad. So what solace have you given by telling someone who's telling you the truth not to tell you the truth or not feel what their truth is? Doesn't make sense. How little sense does it make? Well, let's ask this. If you had a really good day and you came home and your wife said, how'd you do? I had a great day, honey. Got a raise at work. Everything's really fine. Would your wife or husband say, don't feel good? I mean, it sounds stupid. But the minute we tell the truth that we're having a hard time or had some bad moments in a day, we're told not to feel that way. And the underlying thing is, therefore, don't tell me the truth. Okay? So the key for couples is starting, middle, and end have to be truth-based. And the truth-based also applies to listening, not just talking. So if the one spouse says, I had a really hard day, the other spouse has to kind of just take their hand, put it a little bit over their own heart and say, oh, honey, that just must feel terrible. And then in that one thrice, in that one statement with a body gesture, the spouse feels heard. And we have solved half of a problem that doesn't have to evolve after that. And we have much more to discuss and hopefully you're all going to find this helpful in just in your normal marriage stuff, in normal listening and communication, so that you don't ruin something that's good to begin with or don't negatively hand something that has a problem. So this is Russell on Grief Recovery Method, Moving Beyond Loss on HealthyLife.net Radio. Don't go far away.
Timeless information for your self-care and health. HRNradio.com.
Hi, this is Russell Friedman again on Moving Beyond Loss on HealthyLife.net Radio. And lest I forget, let me remind you, www.griefrecoverymethod.com is our website. There are scores and scores of articles we've written there that you'll find helpful. They're free, no cost for them. There's a free ebook you can download, sign up for and download, no cost for that. There's help available for you personally in your community at the Specialist Finder for personal help. You can find one of our certified grief recovery specialists who works in your community within a radius of your zip code. And all five of our books are available there. The Grief Recovery Handbook, the one and only original, which is now in its fourth major edition, the 20th anniversary expanded edition, which in addition to death and divorce and other losses, also gives specific instructions for dealing with loss of health, loss of career, and loss of faith. Many, many editions in that book. Our second book, When Children Grieve, which is for adults to help children deal with death, divorce, pet loss, moving, and other losses. Almost a Bible for parents, especially in that foundation thing with the don't feel bad. Why would you teach your child to lie about how they feel? And that's what we do when we tell them not to feel bad. The third book is called Moving On, which was all about dealing with divorce and other romantic breakups. You can be just as brutally savaged emotionally by a breakup where there was no marriage as if there was. The formality of a marriage doesn't modify the feelings when something ends. Our fourth book is called Moving Beyond Loss, which is a very helpful primer, kind of a guidebook on the myths that we talk about and some of the answers we gave people who called in and gave us really excellent questions. And our latest book, the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss, about which we're very proud. We're sad that it took so long to get it out there, but we're very pleased with how well it's written and how well it's being received and how helpful it is to grieving pet owners who are amongst the most isolated groups of people in our world. Now, back to our topic today, which is living with losses that never end. And we're using as a focus here a family who has a child with a specific condition from which recovery is impossible. Maintenance at only, but a very careful maintenance, because the consequence of a problem could be fatal. And this is not an exaggeration. And we were talking about how the custodial parents, one who's often in the home and other out, how at the end of the day they communicate with each other at a time when each of them are carrying a kind of a load of feelings. The custodial parent at home may be building feelings all day because of the stimulus of being with the child who is heir to the problem, or being afraid of a phone call that can happen any second and have to rush to the emergency room and possibly have a disastrous outcome. Contrasted with the working partner of the couple who might be out being a doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, whatever they're doing, and preoccupied with other things in the workplace with the coworkers and the vagaries of the universe. And they need to get together at home and communicate with each other in a helpful, meaningful way. And the first thing we indicated of the six myths that we point out is to avoid saying don't feel bad when your mate tells the truth. Now, we focused in that first section in that area about the custodial parent of the child saying, I really had a hard day with our son, and having the other parent mistakenly say, don't feel bad, honey, you did the best you could, or don't feel bad, tomorrow's another day. Therefore, by negating the truth that was told, overriding it, implying that they shouldn't feel that way, when the reality is, probably a comment that might be more helpful, gosh, honey, I can't even imagine how painful that was, how frustrating, how scary that was for you. And in that comment delivered that way, at least letting your co-parent know that you heard them. Now, let's turn it around. Let's move off of the tragic medical backdrop and go to the working parent who's out in the workforce. Had a rough day, had been up for a promotion, had jumped through all the hoops, dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's and was really in line for the promotion, and today got word that someone else got it. Someone who wasn't even qualified. Okay? And you tell that to your spouse, and he or she says, oh, don't feel bad, honey. You were really the right one for the job. But you do feel bad. So when your mate who loves you says, don't feel bad, they have delivered an idea that says there's something wrong with you for feeling the way you feel. And it ties into one of the other six myths, and I'm going to jump forward because this is usually near the end of our list, and it's the list about the myth about being strong or being strong for others. In this case, being strong implies that if you were stronger, you wouldn't feel that feeling. And we go, well, you can be strong or you can be human. Pick one. If you get devastating news about something you had hoped you had or thought you had in this job thing, that hurts. It isn't a question of strength. It's a question of a different emotion. And being strong usually means to hide your truth or hide your feeling. Now, how are you going to have a meaningful communication with your spouse if you feel that you have to hide your feeling because if you act strong so your partner won't say, don't feel bad, then you're lying to yourself, lying to your spouse. So what is that set up to happen the other direction? Now, we have two people being afraid to be truthful with each other because the consequence is being told you shouldn't feel the way you feel. Hey, you got to be strong. Buck up. You'll get over it. And then we'll add the other myth that we'll do this in more detail in a minute, but the other myth, time will heal this. But time can't heal it. In fact, let's do that right now. Let's jump right to time. And again, at risk of boring you who listen all the time, you've heard me say probably hundreds of times, not only can time not heal an emotional wound, time can't heal an emotional wound any more than time could put air back in a flat tire. It is the actions we take within time that can help us. So when our mate who loves us says, don't feel better, time will heal you, some part of us almost intuitively goes, uh-uh, because it, even if it were true, which it isn't, that I will feel better next week, next month, next year, when is it that I feel bad? Right now. So we're dismissing my, and it's another way of saying don't feel bad, or adding don't feel bad, in time you'll forget about it. Well, the reality is, when you have a major, major disappointment, you are not going to forget about it. Something like that, where you've been primed to have a major raise at work, you're not going to forget about that anytime soon, and maybe never. So the idea of it diminishing in the impact is not even an accurate idea. So, again, all of us communicate with our spouses and our friends and our family members in the language of things we have learned. But the sad thing is we learn things that aren't helpful, things like don't feel bad and be strong and time heals. So when we get back from a short time out on HealthyLife.net radio, we are going to pick up the other myths that we haven't talked about yet and wrap up this, to me, exciting program, hopefully with some takeaway skills for all of you to apply in your own lives.
Give yourself some love with our self-care programs at hrnradio.com.
Hi, this is Russell Beck on Moving Beyond Loss on HealthyLife.net radio, and also don't forget www.griefrecoverymethod.com. After the last break, I mentioned you can go there and find a grief recovery specialist, someone we've trained in your community for help with personal losses that may be affecting you. But you can also, if in listening to this show you have an inclination or desire to want to help grieving people, there's also a section on the homepage of griefrecoverymethod.com where you can find out about our certification training program, a very powerful 4-day, 8 hours a day program that will, it'll redo your corpuscles. It'll just change what you think and feel, but in the most positive and helpful way, not only for you, but for clients, patients, friends, people that come to you for guidance. Now, back to our topic today, living with losses that never end, and applying the six myths, or trying to get the six myths about dealing with loss out of the loop. We've already talked about don't feel bad. We've talked a little bit about time heals, which it can't. We've talked a little bit about be strong, which doesn't work. I want to go to one, though, that's maybe the most difficult or dangerous in the circumstance we're talking about today with a couple or even an extended family who are dealing with a condition or illness or situation that never gets fixed. And when I talk about the hemophilia, that's one thing, but we can talk about autism, we can talk about Down syndrome, we can talk about many different illnesses or conditions that aren't fixable, that the family has to live with, and that the stimulus or reminder about the broken hopes, dreams, and expectations is there every day in the child or the person with that condition, regardless of age. And I'm going to start this little segment with a question kind of statement, and that is to ask if all of you, or if I said to you that grieving people tend to isolate, would everyone listening kind of nod their head that you've heard that or you know that? Well, it's a fact, not a fact that we can give statistics on because there's nobody does that kind of research. We can just tell you the truth. Grieving people tend to isolate because they learn to. They are taught to. I will say a phrase, and I know all of you will know the last word, so I'll be silent and then we'll add it in. Laugh and the whole world laughs with you. Cry and you cry alone. Everybody knows that. We were brainwashed to believe it, but it is not true. It's a myth that we learn very early in life because we're taught that. We're also taught, if you're going to cry, go to your room, or knock off that crying, or I'll give you a reason to cry. There are a whole host of cliches built around that myth which support the lie. They support the false idea that we're supposed to cover up or hide our sad or painful or negative feelings. So we teach our children to tell the truth about positive things and then to lie about sad things. So when we say, "What's wrong, honey?" they all say, "Nothing," whether they're your spouse or your child, because they learn that they're not supposed to. They also learn something equally false. Don't burden others with your feelings. Now, that might sound okay, that, you know, might be the implication that if someone says, "How are you?" and say, "I'm having a sad day," that you would somehow mung that on them, that your statement of feeling sad would affect them. But if that's true, wouldn't it also be true if you said, "How are you?" to me and I said, "Oh, I'm having a great day," that you could say, "Oh, I don't want to hear that. I'm not, you know, and I don't want to hear your chirpy happiness." So in that level, my happiness could be as much a burden to you as my sadness. Neither of which is true. You cannot technically be burdened by my feelings. You might be burdened by your own. Mine, you hear them, you acknowledge them, you don't have to stay with them. If I start going on and on about something, you say, "Excuse me, I'm busy, got to go now." "Well, I think I hear my mom calling. You know, I heard you the first time," but, you know, the 827th time that you're saying the same thing, you're not doing a value. So grieving alone is a learned phenomenon, not a truth. Here is a truth. Each of us as human beings has a need and desire when something sad happens to talk about what happened and their relationship to that event or that person or whatever happened. In the same way that when something positive happens, each of us has a need and desire to talk about what happened and how good we feel about it if it was positive. Okay? So when someone says that you shouldn't burden others with your feelings, then you keep it now. That's like, don't feel bad. It's bad to feel bad, and then it's bad to talk about it. By the time a child in our society is 15 years old, they've had more than 23,000 inputs suggesting, A, don't feel bad. B, if you do, don't tell anyone. Now, I am in the midst, a very exciting midst of socializing, being part of the socializing of a little girl who just turned 2 a few days ago. She's my granddaughter. Apple of my eye. I can't even say words that explain how I feel. And this is a little girl who doesn't grieve alone. When she's sad, everybody knows it. Top of her lungs, the tears. I mean, sometimes it looks theatrical. She'll stomp her little feet on the floor and fall down face first without hurting herself. I mean, it's theatrical, but it's perfect. Because when she's happy, it's equally perfect. She'll stomp her feet in joy, scream, wail, her face, her whole body smiles. And when she's sad, her whole body cries, which is perfect. And so For the parents out there, what we want is to remove the six myths, the myth of grieving alone, the myth of time healing, the myth of not feeling bad, the myth of being strong instead of being human, the myth of keeping busy, which is just a distraction based on the idea that time might fix you. And the one myth we haven't talked about here today, although it often and sometimes is relevant with families who have a child with a medical condition, and that's the myth of replace the loss. You know, we all learned as kids, or we heard, if you had a dog die, don't feel bad. On Saturday, we'll get you a new dog, or a new parakeet, or rat, or mouse, or whatever. Later, when we're teenagers, we have our first romantic breakup. We hear, don't feel bad. Don't feel bad. It was plenty of fish in the sea, which is the first time we knew we had been dating a fish. And in that, replace the loss, the idea that relationships are replaceable, becomes false. Now, it's a little bit off topic in this area where we're living with a child or other person who has a condition that doesn't get better, but many people will race to create another child to replace the loss of the dreams. And we're not saying that you can't do that, but not from that point of view. The need and desire to have another child has to be more organic, if you will, more emotionally accurate. And you have to be complete with the child and the relationship that you have with them, the one who has a condition, and accept them as a loving part of your life, no matter the degree of difficulty. Otherwise, you will try to get the new child to be what the other one isn't, and it won't be able to be what that child really is. So all of these truths being hopefully evident, if not self-evident, we want you to learn to listen to each other better, talk to each other better. Get a copy of the Grief Recovery Handbook and or When Children Grieve. If you just read in the first part, page through page 58 in either book, you'll get a real open heart information about these myths so you can do something different. I don't want your marriage to break up because you don't know how to talk and because you don't know how to listen. Okay. I love you, each and every one of you. I hope you got some benefit today. We'll see you next month here on Moving Beyond Loss on HealthyLife.net Radio.